Hi, for those who don't know me, my name is John Richardson. I think I know most of you though who are on the call from having been in the conference or conferences. So hello, welcome, and thanks for dropping in for this interesting topic. Let me tell you why this is an issue, at least in my life. As you know, I'm firmly committed to the view that all Americans living outside the United States are on borrowed time with respect to their citizenship. They pretty much got to get out. Things are getting worse and worse. And one of the ways that things are getting worse and worse is their asset levels are getting higher and higher, through inflation, if nothing else. And for those of you who work in the expatriation area, which at this point, probably as anybody who does US tax work, at least has to be aware of this stuff. Unless you've got a dual citizenship exemption from birth or something, once people hit the $2 million net worth, they are subject to this, incredibly brutal 877A expatriation tax regime. And to give us some further context, let me describe it's a situation that is just so unremarkable that I see all the time, and it's something like this. These so-called covered expatriates generally don't have much wealth or money in my world. What they have are assets. And in the city of Toronto, if one were to own a detached house, with a value of prob 1.2 to 1.5, reasonably Canadian. And then if they they've worked and they have a pension, particularly in province of Ontario where I live, the teachers' pensions are simply unbelievable. I mean, they are so generous, so lucrative. So if any of you know people who are looking for a career with a great pension, teaching, it's simply incredible. They can have pensions that are worth a million Canadian, and then you get into these professors at U of T, York, it's around the city. They can be well north of this. And that some of these people may have a second home or something, but my point is simply this, that if you were to add up the value of all these assets, you'd probably trip the $2 million net worth wire. The pension would belong to the individual, but one of the things that happens in life is that people often get married. And, and once they get married, they do things like go and buy a house. So what typically is the case is that we have one individual who has learned that they're afflicted with place of birth disease, that is American citizenship. And who's married, that's the US person, obviously, who's married to somebody who's a worthy individual, that is a Canadian. And it's very common, in fact, it's the default in Ontario, and I think the rest of Canada, to put the title of the home in joint tenancy as opposed to tenants in common. Now, what that means practically in terms of the reason people do this. They don't do things thinking about expatriation taxes. They do things because it makes sense in their life. And the main reason that they put things in joint tenancy without any understanding at all of what it is simply that if one spouse dies, the other automatically inherits the house. It doesn't go through probate and stuff like that. So it makes an awful lot of sense. And that coupled with the fact that under the Ontario matrimonial law regime, for all practical purposes, the ownership of the family, the principal family principal residence 50-50. That's what happens. Now, let's look at the situation here where we have what I call an F-bar marriage, meaning an American married to a non-American. The American has to renounce, clearly. And they come in. And the issue is, can they get out of this without being subject to the exit tax regime or not? Now, there are certain law firms and accountants who are absolutely taking the position that in calculating the net worth, in other words, does the person have $2 million of net worth or not, are absolutely taking the position that the full value of the house needs to be included in determining whether or not they meet that $2 million threshold. Now, think about this for a minute, okay? In the world that I sort of live in, and I think the world you probably live in as well, usually what happens is that, you know, the couple buys the house and, you know, there's not too much anymore of, you know, one spouse staying at home and raising kids. You know, usually these are, you know, by necessity, you know, both partners are working and contributing to the value of that house. Now, clearly, all right, if the answer is that in determining net worth, the full value of the house, let's say $1.5 million Canadian dollars. Actually, let's make it two just because it's easier to divide. And also, by the way, that is not unrealistic at all in the city of Toronto. You know, for it to be, there's probably people on this call whose houses are worth more than $2 million. That would be my guess, all right? So clearly, if the full value is included towards the net worth test, there is absolutely no doubt that they're a covered expatriate, meaning that they triggered the over $2 million threshold. Now, that means they're a covered expatriate. And that's, of course, not a desirable thing as a general principle. But where it becomes absolutely horrendous is if that American, or whatever it is, actually has a teacher's pension or something as well. Because for covered expatriates, what happens is, sure, you've got for the property, the deemed sale, the mark-to-market stuff, which is the way this is always described, you know, when you read blog articles, which is a total distortion of reality, okay? Because if you're in a world where people have pensions, that means that the full $1 million pension or whatever it is would be distributed on renunciation if they're a covered expatriate, right? So we're in a situation where if the full value is included in the net worth calculation, basically they're in big trouble. And if, I'm not sure where my numbers are, but let's hypothesize that if half the value is included, okay, then they're gonna come in below the $2 million and be able to get out of the US citizenship and escape the whole thing. So this, I mean, to put it in simpler terms, what's on the line here is whether their pension gets confiscated or not. Okay. It's, you know, that's how high the stakes are. Now I want to take you through what I believe the answer is and explain why I think the answer is what it is, and obviously invite your input. But I think the answer is that half the value is included, all right, and they're safe. And I would certainly, at least presumptively, encourage you to consider what I'm saying and the reasoning, because for most of the people who work in this, not all by any means, but for most of them, hopefully, you know, you see your job is to help people getting out of this without being subject to this exit tax regime. Incidentally, as you know, real estate, principal residence are not reported on the 8938, all right, or anything like that. So for context, I'm not sure to what extent this matters, but I think it is worth knowing that this is probably the first time that anything about this particular residence would appear, you know, on a tax return at all. So it sounds like, you know, there's, you know, any particular records of this. Okay. Now so we've got to determine the net worth. Okay. Now that's an interesting problem. You know, we're dealing with property, et cetera, but I want to add in something here that I think is of great interest. And that is that the statute that we're working with is 877A, but for the purposes of determining whether somebody's a covered expatriate, it bumps you over to 877, where it's looking at the old rules for the definition. By old rules, I mean the ones that applied in the previous legislation before there was an exit tax, okay? And the reason that that is significant is I think it strengthens the argument that we look to the gift tax regime to determine valuations and not to the estate tax regime, which apparently a large number of people are doing. Okay, so the first step is clearly determining the net worth. Now, so how do we do that when you think about property? Now, this thing was titled as joint interests. The example I'm going to use is joint tenancies in real estate. I do acknowledge that joint interest includes more than that. It would include bank accounts, securities accounts, and there are different and additional considerations that need to be taken into account for those. All right, but nevertheless, all right, let's kind of begin working through this. Now, the first point that I want to make is that we're identifying counting up property interests, okay? And property, the ownership of property and what it is determined under local law, okay? The law of the jurisdiction. Let's just see here, going down here. And here is a, page right off the, I mean, we know this to be true, but for those who are looking for, verification of this, here's what the IRS says on the matter, property rights and federal taxation. As federal law determines how property is taxed, but state law determines whether, and to what extent there are property interests, right? So we look to the local law to determine what exactly is it we're talking about, okay? And then we look to the tax side of it to, once we've determined what it is we're talking about, okay, how whatever it is we're talking about needs to be taxed. Now, if I can just pause for a second and add in the following general comment. The longer I do this, the more it becomes clear to me that you do not look at how things are titled, descriptively, okay? You don't look at how things are descriptively. In other words, the fact that it says joint tenancy might not mean that much until you dig deeper, et cetera. So, I mean, a lot of the job here is, we've got to determine what actually is owned. What is the interest that is actually owned? And so I actually, in preparing for this, did some reading, more than I would have normally, and I discovered some very, very comprehensive, sort of legal research on, the meaning of joint tenancy and tenancy in common. Now, I'm not going to regurgitate that, but the one thing that is, or one of the things that is very clear from the research is that, sure, tenancy in common is a legal interest that has its origins in common law and has been around for something like 800 years, believe it or not. But the meaning of joint tenancy has actually changed a good deal over the years, and different jurisdictions, states, provinces, what have you, may have very, very different rules regarding joint tenancies, and particularly with regard to, okay, so it's called joint tenancy, but what does that actually mean in terms of what the ownership of the interest is? Just sort of parenthetically here, the other option for owning title would be tenants in common. The basic difference is this. I don't want to get overly technical on this because I hated this stuff in law school. I hate it today, and therefore I'm confident most of you would hate it too if you went too deeply into it. But basically, if people own something as tenants in common, let's say that Peter and I buy an office building, okay? And the only reason we do this is because neither of us has enough money, so we're kind of pooling our money. But the point is, these are supposed to be separate interests. Probably we title it as tenants in common, because what that would be saying is that each of us owned, a separate undivided interest, and that, Peter could go sell his interest to Wayne. There's nothing I can do about it. Or Peter could will his interest somewhere else. Contrast a joint tenancy where, you're not going to be able to will your interest somewhere. It's, both people have, you kind of own it jointly with the idea of the right of survivorship. But I would make, and this is an extremely important point for valuation purposes, that although all of these properties in Ontario are owned in joint tenancy, that does not mean that the joint tenancy can't be severed. Okay, it's possible to sever a joint tenancy. You know, leaving aside the mechanics of how to do it, let's say Peter and I did own a property in joint tenancy. One of us could sever that, you know, in a number of different ways. And by severing the joint tenancy, let's say that we were the only two joint tenants, all right, we would be essentially cutting off or severing 50% of it, right? So it can be severed, which means that it can be, in a sense, conveyed, right, you know, through a severance, which means that that this could be valued for gift tax purposes, all right? But we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a second. And, you know, I mean, I've encountered some fascinating articles on this recently where, you know, fraudsters, it's basically field day, okay, you know, when it comes to fraudsters in this area, et cetera. But in any case, we're dealing with joint tenancies, number one. Number two, joint tenancies can be severed, okay, which means that that part of it can be conveyed, which means that it has a value, et cetera. Now, continuing on, John V. Orth, oh my God, I have never seen in my life somebody who seems to understand joint interests in property law better than this guy. He's a professor in North Carolina somewhere, giving you the link there. I think it might be worth it. It's not a short article, but oh my God, it's so rich, okay? You know, he begins with just talking about the history of this, but he does make the point, and this is what I think is most relevant here, is that the interest of a joint tenant can be severed, and that would be an interest that is in proportion to the number of joint tenants. So Peter and I own it in joint tenancy, I sever, it would be a 50% interest. Let's say that Liz, Peter, and I own it in joint tenancy, it would be a third if one of us severed it, et cetera. And that provides the basis for, I think, thinking about the value. Okay, now without getting overly detailed here. Now, so let's imagine we've gotten this far and we know that, you know, we've got an FBAR marriage couple where they own the house in joint tenancy. And the question is, all right, for the purposes of reaching the 2 million mark, how do we determine the value, okay, that one joint tenant's value on the property? And interestingly, the information on that comes from IRS notice 9716. That should be 97, not 99716, but okay. And this has been around for a million years. And what it says in a nutshell is this, that property interest for the purposes. Sorry.
John, it should be 9719.
Is it 19? God, it's even worse. Somebody write that down and give me that at the end so I can fix that slide. Okay. You know, but whatever it is, what it tells you is that to determine the value of the of these properties, you look to the fair market value. You know, if you had a willing buyer, willing seller, this sort of stuff. So let's say we go back to our $2 million property. It seems to me that, now listen to me carefully, assuming that we're dealing with a joint tenancy. Now, the reason I put it that way is there's a very significant body of law here that also makes the point that the fact that the words joint tenancy are used doesn't make it a joint tenancy in Canada, right? In the sense that, you know, one of the so-called joint tenants actually owns an equitable interest in the property. We'll get to that in a second. But that's something else that should be considered, because it is conceivable to me that there can be all kinds of interests that are titled as joint tenancy where the actual value, okay, the actual ownership of one of the joint tenants could be absolutely nothing, okay, depending. But so the bottom line is, and by the way, here are some examples, and I'm giving you the site for this article. And it's very difficult. I don't want to, you know, this is hellishly complex and I can't get into this stuff in an hour. But the point here is that if we're dealing with a true joint tenancy, if that's what we're dealing with, it can be severed. So using the principles in 9719, if I've got it right this time, okay, using the principles in 9719, that would mean that we would start off with a presumption of 50% ownership. Examples two and three here are examples where in a case of a joint tenancy, there may actually be no ownership of a beneficial interest. Beneficial means who actually owns it, okay? You know, the legal title is a different thing. In other words, the joint tenancy is a legal title. It may reflect a true joint tenancy in terms of equal interest and ownership, or it may not, okay? And that's something, this is a very fact-specific inquiry. So I think the message is that the fact you have the words joint tenancy doesn't tell you a great deal about what's going on. Okay. Two fantastic cases here. Peter, you ever read these cases?
No, I don't think so.
I highly recommend them. Okay, they're both superb legal analyses of sort of the history of joint tenancies and, you know, what this stuff actually means in terms of beneficial ownership instead of legal ownership. Because remember that we're charged with this task of trying to figure out what is the property owned by the person, right? And what it's called is not necessarily descriptive of what's actually owned. So, you know, you need a fact-based inquiry here. Okay. Now, you may recall from the conference that when Monty Silver was doing his presentation on gifting, it was gifting away assets, the idea of gifting away the ones with a valuation discount. You know, when things are owned jointly, we don't have complete control over the property. I mean, it's one thing to say that we have a $2 million house and therefore half of the ownership is $1 million. But I don't think that there are too many spouses who would be able to successfully sell their share in the family home to somebody for $1 million because, you know, there's a lack of control, et cetera. So I think it's appropriate to consider, and Monty's answer was interesting on this point, and I agree with him. I think it's appropriate to consider a possible valuation discount. Okay, now I don't know how much the discount should be, but you know, we're dealing with the same lack of control problem that you know we're dealing with with any other sort of partial ownership in something. Okay. All right, now let me pause for a minute, everybody. And I want to make sure that you're 100% with me in the sense that, and this is where I think a lot of the mistakes are made here, and this is where I think a lot of the thinking is really misguided, okay? Step one is to determine whether the net worth level reaches the 2 million threshold. In order to do that, we look at property interests. Property interests are determined not by US law, but under local law. They've made it clear that the gift tax rules figure in here, you know, for the purposes of sort of enshrining the fair market value issue, which, by the way, is precisely the reason why I think that a discount for lack of control probably makes sense. Now, after having done our valuation on all of these various things, we're either above 2 million or we're below. If we're below 2 million, we're very happy people, all right? You know, then of course we have to deal with issues of tax compliance and all that stuff, but we are presumably and defensively in a position where your client is not a covered expatriate based on the net worth test, okay? So far, so good. Now, the next part of the discussion kicks in if they are a covered expatriate. And the question then becomes, what are the rules to determine the exit tax if they are a covered expatriate as those rules are applied to the property in question? So far, so good. Very important you understand there's two distinct steps here. Very important you understand they are very different. And very important that you understand there are different legal principles that apply to each. Because once we get into the taxing an estate, okay, because remember, we're only, the exit tax rules would apply, right, if we have a covered expatriate, all right, then we have to understand what the Internal Revenue Code says on that as well as we can, all right, and work from that. Now, to understand why the tax laws are written the way they are, all right, let's go back again to the definition of a joint tenancy. So a joint tenancy means the moment one joint tenant dies, the interest vanishes, it just goes to the other joint tenant. And that's why people use it, right? I mean, sure, it's a way of avoiding probate. But another way of putting it is if somebody dies, it doesn't go to the estate of the decedent. It goes directly to the other joint tenant. And if it doesn't go to the estate of the decedent, let's say you're the taxing authority trying to tax that estate, are you happy or are you sad? Well, you're sad because the operation of the joint tenancy rule has basically removed that from the estate to be taxed. And this is the basis for the rules, okay, that appear that really, well, they are draconian, okay, but at least an explanation for why they are what they are. So now, I think it's prudent to look at what the IRS says on this. And again, their basic discussion is in a notice, it's not binding, a 2009-85. And they say some interesting things here. What they actually say is that, now I want you to notice the way that is written. Okay, this is how the 877A rules work. They're talking about the identification, notice it says, of a covered expatriate's property, covered expatriate. That is not talking about, you know, how you go and evaluate property interest for determining whether somebody's a covered expatriate. You've got to be a covered expatriate. And interestingly, and I think predictably, right, if they start off with the notion that it's the gift tax principles that one would use to determine the value, it's the estate tax principles that they're sort of prescribing to determine how those interests are taxed, assuming somebody's a covered expatriate. Now, a moment ago, I reminded you that the fact that it's a joint tenancy means that at the moment of death, it goes to the other person, it leaves the estate, right? Okay, so it's hard as a matter of property law, all right, to catch these things long enough to tax them. So therefore, okay, sure, we're going to use the estate tax rules. But again, going back to Professor Orth, who puts this ever so well, you know, he articulates, if you're with me so far, what is the obvious. So the Internal Revenue Code, and I presume other taxing state, creates a legal fiction where, not so fast, we're going to not let that joint interest just leave the estate. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, it's here long enough for us to tax it. And oh, by the way, okay, to make sure that we're able to tax it, the default rule on this is that, okay, you'll find this in Internal Revenue Code 2040. The default rule is that the amount of the joint interest that goes into the estate is the full value, okay, and not a half value. Now, obviously, from anything other than a theoretical point of view, that is absolutely insane. It's batshit crazy, right? Because what it means is, I mean, it's shocking. What it means is that although the estate doesn't own anything because of the operation of the joint tenancy rules, not only are we going to leave it in the estate, but we're going to impose tax on the whole value and not even half the value. Like, this is unbelievable. Now, given the depravity of this, all right, they loosen that up. Okay, so step one is the full value is included for the purposes of the exit tax calculation. Because remember, they're sort of interpreting how the exit tax rules should be in terms of these estate rules. But they recognize, you know, some obvious things. Okay, the first is that with a married couple, that makes no sense, okay, at all. So what they do is they say, all right, it's 50-50. Okay, if it's a married couple. But we know how much the United States hates anything that's, well, not America. And they have a special hatred for the non-US citizen spouse. Because if the non-US citizen spouse were to be the recipient of these assets, oh my God, they'd leave the US tax system. Agreed? Those assets would leave the US tax system. And what we know is that Americanness is first and foremost about taxation. So for that reason, if we go further down into the Internal Revenue Code, you can see part of this, no surprise, disallowance, you know, it's written in technical language, but the bottom line is that you don't get the allowance if your spouse is not a US citizen. Now, there are some other things you can do, and there are treaties that cover this, blah, 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 but just in the theory of it. So what happens is that if the non-US citizen spouse doesn't, if the deduction is not available with a non-US citizen spouse, we're kind of punted back up to the original rule in 2040. And what I didn't tell you is that the original rule, although it starts out with a default of the full joint value coming into the estate, what it actually goes on to say, and it's not hugely, it's not the most lucid thing out there, but what it says is that to the extent that one can demonstrate that the asset was funded by or contributed to by somebody other than the decedent, then an adjustment will be made in that regard, okay? So putting this in the context of the FBAR marriage, all right, what we have is assuming that a covered expatriate, we don't want to get them there, okay? Assuming a covered expatriate, we have full value of the house would be sucked into this for the purpose of calculating the exit tax, presumptively, but the presumption can be rebutted to the extent that one can show that the alien, okay, contributed to the purchase of it. And my experience with this is, my general sense of this is, that it's reasonable to take a 50-50 allocation based on that, okay? And I certainly would try to identify the facts that support that. I mean, I think in the modern world, you can probably come very, very close to presuming that. But you never know. Okay. Now, as always, there's the statute and there's the regs. And the regs more or less go over what I just said. All right. So I should repeat what I just said, okay, in relation to it. Let me give you the bottom line first and then explain why. The bottom line, I think, is this, that assuming sort of a modern marriage where both couples are working, it's reasonable, okay, to, for the purposes of exit tax calculations, to include 50% of the value, okay, and not the full value. Even though the spouse is not a U.S. citizen, right? The statute, if both spouses are U.S. citizens, makes it a no-brainer. It's deemed to be 50-50, okay? But if the statute is not, if the spouse is not a U.S. citizen spouse, then you come back to the general rule, which is we're going to presume the full value of the house comes in, but we're going to relax that to the extent that one can demonstrate that the non-US citizen spouse contributed to the purchase value, et cetera. So that's where I think we actually are with this. Now, I would add also that I've been talking about this in the context of the family home. After reading this and getting into this, the most interesting decisions on this have to do not with the joint interest in real estate, but with the joint interest in bank accounts and things like that. And there is no question that, you know, particularly for high net worth people, this type of stuff is an issue. So something I would add, but I can't get into this now because of the time and everything, is that I wouldn't say there's a different set of rules for brokerage accounts and things like that, but I would say that the application of the rules can play out, you know, sort of differently. So my message to you, I think, would be this, that you got to understand exactly what's going on in terms of, you know, who from a practical point of view owns this stuff, and try to make your decisions in a defensible way based on that. The worst thing you could do would be to look at a joint tenancy and then just start applying rules presumptively. It's the worst thing you could do. And I want to add that I absolutely positively disagree and believe that the notion that for the purposes of calculating the net worth, you include the full value of the house held in joint tenancy, I believe that is completely wrong. I believe it is obviously dangerous because it walks people into a situation where they're going to be subjected to the exit tax. And that means different things, you know, for different people. But for people who have pensions, which is a lot of people, I mean, my God, it's a total disaster. So once again, just going through the sequencing. One, you got to determine the property value, the valuation of the property. Two, property interests are determined according to local law, in my case, mostly Canadian or Ontario law. Okay, you know, for the purposes of determining what is owned and therefore determining what the valuation of that stuff is. For most, in most cases, I would take the 50%, okay, to determine whether the, you know, the value for the purposes of determining the 2 million, okay, in most cases. You know, I think that's entirely reasonable. And hopefully you're going to be below the 2 million. If you're above the 2 million, then you get into the whole exit tax calculation of the regime. But even in that case, if you do a certain kind of factual determination that I think makes a great deal of sense, my view on this is that you take 50%, okay, of the value for calculating the exit tax and not this 100% stuff. So I'd be very, very careful with this. I think that there are people out there who are doing extreme disservices, you know, to their clients by simply, you know, taking the position that the full value of the house gets included. What it does is it makes them covered expatriates, which, if that isn't bad enough, results to the basic confiscation of their pensions. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. Those are my thoughts on it.